States president who has the nerve and the courage to speak out against capital punishment. That will be a day that will just bring me joy to no end, because that I find that to be that will be the forever be like the cancer of our culture, that we can accept that as institutionally we can murder people. It just is, it's craziness.
What do you do with them though? What do you do with people that are like John Wayne Gacy, the extreme cases? What do you do with people that are just
keep them from hurting people and himself?
That's it.
Why? What else would you do with them?
I don't know. I have no answers with that. I've been back and forth.
I don't know why. But what is the point of? I mean, what is the advantage of killing them?
Well, because they have a lot of fun in prison, like Gacy did. And am I studying serial killers? Right. I've gone back and forth, and a lot of serial killers like that want to go to prison. That's just
right. Fair enough. So what if he has fun?
Well,
if he's not hurting anybody,
to watch his he did not only destroy 33 people, but the whole family's destroyed. When, like, I've been up to my ears in that stuff, and to watch right. every single family member destroyed from what happened to their younger brother.
Okay. Hi. Hey, how's it going? I'm good. I'm just doing an interview. Are you all right? Okay. How's the swim? I'll call you back. Sorry.
And I don't want to make this about capital punishment. No, I've just gone back and forth on it.
The point is this. Like, there may be people who have done horrible things there are people who have done terrible things. And those people may, at some point, they may actually experience, like, joy or whatever after they're in jail. Fair enough. I don't think to snuff out that possibility, like, requires the acceptance of the idea that institutionally we just murder people. I just don't think it's worth it. To me, it's not a fair trade. It's not a reasonable trade. I actually have met people who have done horrible things in their life, and they're just human beings. John Wayne Gacy is a human being.
Yeah, right.
Right. He's just a person, and he fucked up. He's like, something went wrong. There was a confusion. I don't believe in evil.
Me neither.
So I just think that, like, people, I don't think John Wayne Gacy, for instance, I don't think he's an evil guy. I think what happened, however, was horrific, terrible, brutal, and apparently a consistent component in the human, like, being. I don't know why this, in the human race, we always have to, like, there's all this brutality. I don't get it. But I just don't believe, actually, that killing people is actually helping the situation. And in fact, societies in which people are being just get killed regularly, I think actually it exacerbates, because it makes life seem expendable. So if life is expendable, then why not take some?
Such an example.
Of course. Yeah, I mean, as just culture, of course. I mean, if you think about like the Cambodia killing fields, like, what was happening to people? Like, how did they get to the place where people could just be like, okay, you're an artist, you're a teacher, you're a scientist, I'm gonna shoot you all in the head. I mean, who's pulling the trigger and what's on their mind? I mean, how do they reach that numbness? They didn't think about the fact, oh, you're a person, I'm a person. You know, so I feel like that there's a institutionally as a culture, like, if you, for instance, lived in a house and in the backyard every day there was kittens being killed, you may like kittens. I don't know if you like kittens or not, if you're a cat
I don't
person.
Want them killed, but I don't like them in my house.
All right, well, I don't know which animal.
Puppies.
Okay, puppy. Do you like a puppy? So every day out back, like, or, you know, there's a guy who kills puppies, right? And it's completely sanctioned and legal. But it's right outside your window. And you live in that house. At some point, you're going to stop feeling it. It's the only way to contend with it. It doesn't make any sense. It's nonsensical he would kill the puppies. They're doing nothing. They're just cute.
Or you're going to lower yourself to the level of him and go out trying to throw brain him with a rock.
That's
or something.
It's the same thing.
Right.
You can't. It's incomprehensible. So I just think that ultimately, like, that numbness is what allows the government then to, like, can do that. It can also do this. I mean, the fact that this country has been drawn into these really horrific situations. And the thing about Iraq, it's not like some guys in like in a Humvee driving around checking up on like possible insurgents. I mean, people are being eviscerated, incinerated. Like, this is chaos.
On a daily basis.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. I read some article where they said if when people go out to work, there's like a 25% chance they're not going to come home from work that
day. Right.
So people are afraid to leave their homes there.
And even if it was 75%, or let's say it was like 2%, why are we going to be involved in making their lives? I just don't understand this. It doesn't make any sense. And I think as a country, though, as a culture, we kind of like, well, it's war. Fuck war.
So where, as a people or as a culture, where did we go wrong? Where did, because it does seem against, like, the human animal to be so... I mean, there's violence in animal kingdom, but not like a...
I don't think it's conscious violence.
No, right. It's like you stepped on my territory, so right. It's not like murder of mass people. So where did we go wrong? You know, where did things...
I have no fucking clue. But, I mean, I actually don't... Again, I think humans are...
The Unabomber would say it's the Industrial Revolution.
Well, I was about to say, I mean, the Unabomber... Yeah, you're right. Kaczynski would have said something along those lines.
I think he
had
a point.
I will say that. He does have a point, of course. I think that. I think, in my mind, at least in our culture, the overriding emphasis is on profit and wealth. And I think it's actually the modern form of power. It is power, but it's sort of like before, like, you know, there were royalty or kings or like this guy is the biggest sword and cuts off more people's heads. But ultimately, you know, now it's like the warriors, the really powerful people are the rich people. And profit is so dominating in almost all business conversations. Like everything in our society, for instance, if I told you like, oh, I'm a football player. Like, I love to play. I play football. I'm like, really? Yeah, I'm a football player. I'm like, who do you play for? I'm like, oh, yeah, play around. You're not really a football player because you're not playing for the NFL or something, you know. But what if I love football more than anybody? What if I, you know, like, or I'm an actor. And you're like, well, yeah, what movies you been in? No, I don't. Yeah, I'm just acting with some guys in the corner. You're like, well, you're not really an actor. Because what makes these other people feel like, what makes these other sort of NFL and all that stuff, it's the money. It's just the money. It's just the exposure and the money. And that's, so I feel like that the emphasis on profit, and especially in music. I mean, I know this in music. I mean, you said to me like, oh, this seemed like a really important place for us to come, or you're really well known, or I'm not well known. Like, I am well known within a very tiny sliver of our society. I don't exist in most American society because I'm not on television. I'm not rich. I'm just a fucking guy. And I'm invisible. In this street, I live in Washington, D.C. my entire life, in Washington, D.C. And I am invisible in this city. I can go to other cities and be like, oh my God, you're, you know. But here, I'm nothing. Because this city it just doesn't even recognize. I'd have to be, yeah, Elton John or something.
But that's with everything. But you have creeped up into pop culture. I just read an interview where you talk about being on a baseball, like the World Series. A Fugazi song made it on there, isn't it?
Yeah, but I didn't.
But it creeped up.
Yeah, that's I love it.
Yeah,
I love that the reason I love it though is not because it's a way of getting my music out or a way of, you know, or like, you know, or to me sort of like, oh, you're really, you know, your music is so brilliant. Look, the World Series is using it. Rather, what I love about it is that, and I think this is a little bit of something that I felt last night when Obama was elected. What I love about the fact that my work, the punk rock stuff that I've been involved with, continues to bubble up and show up on the surface is that it, to me, it's proof that it's still possible for culture to have something real could actually be insinuated into the whole fabric. Because there's no publicists, there's no machinery behind this. It's just us. We just did our songs, people, and I mean us, I mean the people who like the band, but the people, it's like, it just, it's our music. It's not, there's no corporation behind it. It's just us. And the fact that it, like, that, that it's been woven into, like, the American kind of cultural fabric now, it just means it's possible. It's still possible. They haven't managed to plug every hole. They haven't managed to put their toll booths at every entrance. There's still a couple free spots.
Yeah, well, you're right about maybe you're not as famous or as popular or well-known as a Michael Jordan, but you are in our culture.
Right, but our culture is tiny.
Right. In the world perspective, yes.
My point being is that the other people, the really well-known artists, are usually generally people who's, it's not that they've had necessarily, they come from an environment of like influential thinking. Rather, they come from an environment of affluent thinking. Like they're just rich. they got a lot of money. You know, I mean, the celebrities, like the, some of the people, like, you know, the most, you know, we're going to pop out names right now. People always say, who are like a famous celebrities? I mean, by and large, everything, it's always, they're always just wealthy people. They're just people who have enormous, ridiculous wealth. They're the people who eat at the picnics. They throw away the $50,000 worth of chickens or whatever. You know, you're just talking about that. You know, that's it. That's, they don't, it's just waste. It's just total opulence. And that's what people are like, wow. Like, I know because I have a lot of friends who are those people. And I know when I go out, I mean, people are like, oh, yeah, you're that dude from so-and-so. But they're like, oh, shit, can I talk to him? Because he's very rich. You know, they're scared that people are very...
They say that about you?
No. I'm saying I'm with somebody else.
Oh, right.
They talk to me because I'm approachable. But the other person, like, oh, he...
So do you think capitalism is a cancer?
I think it probably is a way this... I mean, I don't know. I didn't go to college. I never studied any of these things.
I'm a high school dropout myself. Right.
So I don't know the actual definitions of these things. So I wouldn't say capitalism. Certainly I would say that in my lifetime, in my estimation, the way capitalism has been practiced in this culture, I would say it is deeply diseased system. I don't know if it's a cancer or not. Cancer at the moment is apparently incurable. So if I was to pass it as cancer, then I might think, well, then it's hopeless. I'm pretty hopeful. You don't really have to look any further than, say, the healthcare situation. I mean, why is it so hard to fix? It's because it's just money. It's always money. It's just money. I mean, recently, Amy and I, we had a kid in May, and everything was great leading up, and everything has been great since he was born. But in that little window of time where we had to interact with the medical system, because in Washington, D.C., you almost were forced into the hospitals. You're forced in the hospital because midwives can no longer afford malpractice insurance. And because they don't have malpractice insurance, they can't have privileges to work at area hospitals. So if you want to have your kid at home and something goes awry, then suddenly you're put into like a hospital with a whole new scene, like a crew of people, and you lose the people you've been working with. But that little window of interacting with the doctors was just a mess, like really interesting mess. And thinking about what went down and why it happened that way, I realized that what was really at work was procedures sort of imposed on what is the most organic, like, thing in the world, like birth, right? I mean, it's like, it's probably the most organic human experience, certainly, birth. I mean, I can't imagine anything more natural, but the structures that have been imposed on it by that industry, largely is in terms of costs and insurance issues. You really realize, wow, what a perversion. What this, like, of all things, that birth would be treated as an illness. It's incredible. I mean, something has gone terribly wrong. Terribly, terribly wrong. They even have a song called All These Governors. And it's not a song sort of raging about how government is inefficient. Rather, that it's a song about the idea that government, in many ways, is extremely efficient. And the lyric, sort of there's a refrain, says, when things that should work don't work, that's the work of all the governors, or all these governors. And the idea behind that is that the government largely is acting on behalf of the corporations. So to keep things, to keep the power in the hands of those corporations, they will undermine things that could be not just naturally could work out. Like last night, for instance, you were in Washington, D.C., and the streets were filled with people running around, all sorts of different kinds of people. But no one got shot. No one got killed. People they don't hate each other. They don't want to do that. They don't. It's like, but I can tell you, having gone to many, many, many protests, that the problem was not the people, it was the police.
Absolutely.
Right. And anybody who was in St. Paul would tell you, it was the police. It was not the people.
And I wonder why people can't see that when they see watch TV. A lot of people complain about protests, but none of those protests came with guns.
No.
They didn't come with weapons. No. They say, well, this stick was a weapon. Come on. Guns are in high school.
Right.
Those guys wanted to come with pistols.
But this has been going on for... This is, I think, this one of the other most central issues in this culture. Like, you know, like another thing that people have been blind to this all along, that the violence comes from the police. But by that behavior, create situations will then become distractions. And this is the idea of, like, the idea that government will always trip things up, because if it could just go smoothly, then they'd have nothing to do, you know, and there'd be no way to profit on it, because people would just, I'm going to grow some food. You want to buy the food? You want to trade me? You know, like, these, I'm not talking about a utopian existence. I'm just talking about, like, reasonable, like, why is there everything have to be so hard? Like, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but like flying, like to fly is just absurd. It's completely absurd. Like, you go on one, the idea of security on flights is just ridiculous. It's so ridiculous. Like, getting on a plane, we just flew the day with our boy. We got on the plane, National Airport in Washington, D.C., the most secure conscious airport, right? We got on the plane with a baby. Nobody said a boo to us. We just got on the plane, sat down, took the flight to L.A. Coming back, we were stopped. They said, the baby needs a boarding pass. We said, but why? Like, we didn't use one coming out. They said, well, you had to have one. I said, why? You know, like, why would we? They said, well, because, you know, basically, if you crash, you want to know who was on the plane. I said, well, that seems reasonable. I can't understand why were we allowed to go through three security checkpoints and get on a, you know, go on board. And no one ever said boo to us getting on the plane. There's just no rhyme or reason.
No, when we're talking about St. Paul and the police, you know, I also, when I was looking at that situation on the TV, and then I thought about the 68 convention, I wonder why we are, why the protesters, who I would consider myself on their side, haven't figured out a different solution, because it's just like a cycle. Every 4 years, they go and get hit with clubs and cause this distraction, and there's no different action. And in 68, when you saw what happened in Chicago with the riots, you think protesters and stuff would have said that we have to figure out a different way around this. We have to figure out a different way to protest.
I have to say, first off, people have figured out all sorts of different ways, and they do it. You just don't hear about it because it's not television news porn.
Well, I don't watch TV, but I try to pay attention.
It's not media porn. You know about the violence because our culture is obsessed with violence. I also think the 68 convention was an incredible achievement on the part of the people.
Right.
I mean, it changed the politics in this country forever. Now, not necessarily always for good, but the other day I heard someone talk about, like, a dubious moment in history in the 68 riot. They're talking about the Grant Park thing last night, and they said, like, the site of a really dubious moment in our history. Not dubious on the part of the protesters. dubious on the part of the police and the government daily. You know, that was dubious. But I think actually that the people who protest the conventions, they are struggling to crack the sort of the seal that these two entities, Democrats and Republicans, have created. Basically, it's like the World Trade thing. You know, every time they have a meeting in Washington, the World Trade people, or the IMF, or the World Bank, mm-hmm. whatever. The World Bank sits in a building just across the river from here in downtown Washington, D.C. When they have a meeting in the building, they will close 15 city blocks. They'll block people, 15 city blocks that you or I couldn't cross a police line to walk on. Because these fuckers are having a meeting in one room, in one building. This doesn't make any sense at all. You know, but I think that the same way with the conventions, I think people would like to feel like, hey, like we're allowed here too. And they go to say, we're allowed. But then what they're met with, I mean, the truth is, it's not why the people continue to use that tactic. The question is, why the police continue to use that tactic? What would the people do if
it makes sense why the police didn't use the tactic, though. Fear, control, they get it on TV, they show these big black uniforms. Right. It looks scary. It makes people afraid to go and protest.
That's why I think people who go into protest and to risk put themselves in harm's way, what they're really trying to expose is that the government is engaging in fear tactics.
Do you think revolution is possible?
How do you define revolution?
Revolution as within an actual moment in like the 68 convention or something that close where people are rising up and create almost an immediate change.
Might have seen one last night.
Might have. I mean,
I think you probably in 68, if we were sitting here the day after the Democratic National Convention, you might be like, might have. You just don't know. These things resonate. They, you know, like about sound waves?
Yes, a little bit.
Like, The higher frequencies are short, but the lower ones have a very long. That's why, like if you hear like thunder, will roll forever, or a train horn, or like a whale call.
Okay,
like those are long, low waves. So if you go to see a show and you're right up front, you're gonna get the high. You'll hear the guitar right in your face. But if you go way in the back of the room, you'll feel the more the low end, because that the low end, the waveform is long and it takes longer to develop. And that's why if you're far, far away, you'll hear the rumbling before anything else. A lot of times, transformative moments occur, the effects of which you don't really start to grapple with until years later. And I have to say, like, I'm not trying to be some PBS cornball or some shit, but, I mean, I actually think last night was that, you know, part of that, like, in the 60s, having grown up during the civil rights stuff as a child and being so connected and remembering Martin Luther King being assassinated and being, like, so, like, I mean, for me, there's not many things in my life that I think are gross, that I think, oh, gross, oh, that makes me feel sick. But seeing someone being hit by a cop, that makes me sick.
Yeah.
You know, that's like, that to me is obscenity.
But it's usually a girl or someone right. small or someone not violent.
Or, as a child, it was usually a black person.
Hmm.
Like, that's what I was seeing. And civil rights stuff, it is just upset me in a way that I still am not over. Seeing that and being around that and seeing it still to this day being practiced is just insane. And seeing that kind of imagery as a child and being aware of the, it didn't make any sense to me. Like, that, you know, that what was happening with white America and black America, I just couldn't figure it out as a child. I was, what is the problem? You know, and I remember when King was assassinated and riots spread through Washington. And I seriously thought that was going to be, we would be killed by black people. Because as a child, I started like, man, it's just like, our black, like the white person killed a black guy. Does that mean now the black people are going to kill all the white people? Like, I was six, so I was a little bit, the whole thing was pretty confusing. All this, point of all this is that the civil rights era and my subsequent studying of it had a really profound impact on me, something that I really have thought about a lot. And I have to say, like, last night watching the Obama, the acceptance speech, but almost more profoundly, when his extended family came on stage, it just blew my mind. That is a long, long, long wave, 40 years. It's a waveform, but that effect, that transformative moment of what happened in the 60s is still resonating. It resonates now. And it's possible that this election, it's possible. I'm not saying we're done, we're finished. It's actually, we're never finished.
Right.
But this election may well result in the beginning of a whole new wave that will take years to play out. But that's a transformative moment. It could have been that. Or maybe not. Maybe it was just another, you know, some dude just got elected. Who knows?
So why do you do what you do?
What else should I do?
I have no idea. I just wonder why. What?
I have no idea. It's what I do. I have no, I don't, it just seems, people say, like, why do you do that? But why shouldn't I do it? I can't think of why I shouldn't. It just feels like the thing to
do. I just wonder where it came, what was the spark? Like, you're talking about the civil rights spark and how it's still resonating today. What sparked you?
Probably my parents first and foremost, and then, sorry.
Oh, I'm good.
Probably my parents first and foremost.
That's what I'm asking.
Right,
really.
And then my commute, like the kid I grew up with, you know, and then, well, of course, somewhere my brain's involved and my being. Growing up in Washington, D.C., I think had a pretty profound impact on me. Growing up in the era in which I grew up in was profound. I think I was raised to question authority and to not trust the government. Not that the government can only do wrong, but that not assume that it would always do right. That's when you get into real trouble. When you're like trusting your government, like, yeah, no problem. You got to check them because you just got to check them. You got to follow up on these things.
Like trusting doctors.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. They're just people who have, like, they're just trying to get through their day and they're making decisions, especially the way things are structured. And again, corporate bureaucratic structures are like anti-human. That's their job. I mean, that's precisely the point. Like, it's not profitable to be human. If they could make it all machines, then there would be no, then you'd have the perfect, like, corporate structure. There would be no human error whatsoever. It would just be perpetual computer machinery, like, error, whatever. But it always land, like, all machines are always, sorry, but all machines are always said that if it makes a mistake, it would make the mistake in the, you know, in favor of the company. You know, it's never going to go the other way. So I think that I just was raised at a time where I thought that was just normal. Like, my it's just normal to question authority. Like, you know, I'm not a religious person. Like, I'm not a member. I'm not a Christian, or I'm not a subscriber to anything. I don't have any agenda like that whatsoever. However, I'm baptized Episcopalian. My father's, both my parents were theologian, like kind of expert people. My father, at one point, had thought of being a priest. He's still really involved with the Episcopal Church. But the Radical Episcopal Church. And I was baptized at a church called St. Stephen's in Incarnation. It's 16th and Newton Street. And as a child, you know, I went every Sunday with my family. And that church was an inner city frontline church that was grappling with the issues of the people. It was, you know, it was a church that was on the forefront of liberation theology. The rector, William Wendt, was a really serious fighter. And, you know, this was a church that was in one of the worst neighborhoods in Washington at the time. And he was instrumental in, first off, integrating the church. It had been a white church in a black neighborhood, which resulted in a terrible schism. The church split up, and the people who didn't want to integrate left and went to another, and they started a new church outside of the city. He was involved with civil rights, deeply involved with civil rights in the church. Stokely Carmichael, I believe, spoke at the church. It was the Black Panthers were in and out of the church pretty regularly. The church was had gay marriage in 1972, 73. Wayne Schwant and John Fortunato, I think his name was, the time of those guys. The Father Wendt was almost excommunicated from the church for allowing a woman to say mass long before women priests were allowed in. It's just a badass. And it just, that seemed normal. Like, we removed the pews in the front of the church and just put, like, cushions on the floor. And people sat on the floor. It just seemed normal to me. And it was scary. Like I got beat up by kids in church. You know, there's other tough, it's a city church. And, like, I was, like, I'd be running around playing with the kids, and some other, like, kid just jacked me up. And then, like, you know, like, in the church, you know, I'd get beat up by some kids who just would mess with me. Or we have people come off the street and during a service and try to steal something. It was a pretty interesting experience. And when King was assassinated and the riots broke out, this church is a block and a half from 14th Street Quarter, which was at that time the epicenter of the rioting in the city. And there was terrible, terrible rioting on that street. The fire buildings were burning. It was Palm Sunday, 1968. And we... Father went, and the church decided that we would celebrate Palm Sunday on 14th Street. So we left the building and marched together down 14th Street amidst, I mean, seriously, like, smoldering buildings and police. And I mean, there weren't people, like, shooting and running around, but it was in the Sunday morning, and it was like the residuals, like, riot scene. And we had the service outside in front of this building or house, and I have this very clear recollection of a woman named Mother Scott. She was a blues singer that was a fixture at the church, and she played guitar, like, for the service. She played guitar and sang, I don't know, probably she sang We Shall Overcome or something, you know, sounds like that. But whatever it was at that moment, I thought, wow, like, look what music is doing right now. Look where we are. Look what our position, like, where we stand in this situation. Like, we stand for peace. Like, we stand for repair. Like, we're not scared of the street. We're on the street, and music is gluing us together. You know, that was like, music is no joke. Serious. This is serious. These kind of moments, I think, that experience, that church was really, I think, had a huge effect on me. I will also say, though, that very early on, the early 70s, it became clear. I started to learn about all the infighting about church. I also started to think about, like, the doctrine of it, and just, like, I cannot hang with this.
So do you find there's a difference between religion and spirituality?
Of course.
Do you find, are you an atheist?
I mean, if people ask me, obviously I'm a faithful agnostic. I don't really give, I don't know. I don't think it's, I just don't, I'm just not a subscriber. That's the main thing. You know, and I think that a lot of times people think, well, he must subscribe to something. He must be this, that, or you. And I don't, I'm not. I don't, I actually, I don't hate religions. I don't, I just don't, I just, I'm just me.
Do you consider yourself an anarchist?
No.
Yeah, a lot of people assume that you would not be voting. A handful of people we spoke to.
Well,
I
don't think he does.
He's an anarchist. And I said, really? Where'd you read that?
Yeah.
I didn't find it anywhere.
I don't even know. I mean, again, like, I'm probably, in my practice, I'm probably more of an anarchist than most self-described anarchists. But I don't, I'm not an ist anything. I'm just a person. Yeah. I'm just not, I don't, I'm not a subscriber. I'm just a person. I just do my work.
So you feel that music, I would assume you consider it artwork. Music is art? Is art necessary in our society?
Yeah.
For everyone.
What does that mean?
Like, I think sometimes plumbers, when I grew up watching my plumber families, they would work really hard, they'd come home and they'd drink really hard. And that's where I felt like if they had art in their lives... You know, like they beat their children or they were really drank really hard. That was their art. And I felt that they had a little creativity. Maybe the word art is a
pretentious. I think expression.
Expression. Like, I hate the word art myself. But right. So when I saw them, I was like, when I grew up in that, I was thinking, man, if he just had something, like a guitar or paintbrush or whatever his fetish was, whatever he was tripped to, they wouldn't have that problem.
I suspect that, I don't know this, I didn't go to college. I suspect that, not that anybody in college knows either.
That's right.
I would suspect that part of being a human being, that there is a component within us that is what we do, whether it's making music or art or building things or cooking or just something. It's just we're just connected to that. I don't know how these things work. Like, for instance, if you see like a... Is it a dachshund, the little long skinny dog? You know what I'm talking about, those little dogs? And like they're, you know, they're designed to go into holes to go after their prey. You know, they go down into, the toucans have the big, who are the birds with the big, what are the birds with the big beaks? So they can carry all the fish in them. What do they call them?
Pelicans.
Pelicans, right. Sorry, pelicans. I mean, you start seeing that in nature, there's all these different designs, like these animals have these really different designs, and you think like, what is that for? And of course nobody really knows, but you start to think, oh, I get it. Like, you know, the woodpecker has a really strong beak so it can dig into the tree and get the insects, whatever. I mean, they're, or like the, you know, the cheetah, you know, it's fast because it can cap, you know, there's all these different kind of like ways that these animals have either, you know, have evolved. Like there's something to their actual being. I suspect that each of us also have something that we just are, we just should do. I don't know what it is exactly or how to describe that. For me, music is not a choice. I don't think music is necessary for everybody. I think music is necessary for everybody. Do you see? Not each everybody, but all everybody, of course. Yeah.
To me, it's about finding your passion in life. If that's plumbing, that...
Maybe... I think that probably people who beat their children are angry at themselves, but we often hit those who are within arm's reach. And that's our families. People who beat their children are angry with themselves. And they're angry with themselves because they're not doing what they're supposed, they want to do. I don't know what that is, so... That's what I suspect. You know, so I would say music is an expression. I've often said that music is a form of communication that almost certainly predates language. So obviously it's been around forever and ever. I imagine that design and visual art also predates language. I would imagine that people would put things, look at, you know, line things up, rocks or sticks or, you know, it's just because they're translating. They're seeing something and they're able to recreate it. I mean, music, artists are translators ultimately. Like you're making a movie right now and you said to me earlier, oh, you know, can I film? Because I like the idea of just filming without it being an interview because the conversation quite often is, whatever, it goes into a different direction. But what it really reveals is that you, what you're trying to capture, what you're trying to capture is your translation of what you see, what you think, what you hear. And I mean, ultimately, when I make music, like, I'm hearing something out there in the world. And then when I play a guitar, I'm trying to say, here's what I'm hearing. Like, I'm going to filter it and put it into a distilled version for you. If I'm an artist, like, you know, photographer, like, a photo is like, you know, just take a picture. But if you start thinking about what makes a great photo, it's because a photographer sees the composition of something. Photographer sees it and is able to capture it, distill it, and say, here's what I saw. Here's what I saw. So there's that kind of pass-through aspect of it. It's translation. And I think that most people, or all people, there's something that they are like made to translate. But I think quite often, again, because of the structure of our society, and because of the idea that making money is the primary goal, that quite often, that which they are built to translate, like, that's what they are built to do, is suffocated by what they think they're supposed to be doing in terms of making money or making a living. I'm a bit elusive on that for people, because I don't expect people to understand me always, and it's okay if they don't. I don't see my life, I've worked hard to not see my life as a movie that everybody has to understand and see and get. I'm just one of billions of living beings on this earth. I mean, for all the issues that we are talking about, and all the kind of, like, you know, you're stressing about these things, that you study this and I study this, we think about it, doesn't mean a fucking thing, ultimately. You know, like, I mean, right now, at this very moment, like, this entire block could just explode. A crack could open up and drop us in, and we'll be just eviscerated. And it won't mean a thing, really, to most of the people in this world. Just most of the people in the world. It won't mean a thing. It will have zero effect on the revolution of this earth. That the earth will just continue to spin. Like when the planes crashed in the 2001, and the Pentagon is 3/4 of a mile over there. I could walk through to the top of the hill and look straight over and see the smoke. You know, I woke up, people were calling me, like, did you look? And I looked, I turned the television on, and I saw the second plane hit, and I was like, oh, it's not an accident. Okay. I get it. Human brutality again. And I just turned the TV off. I'm just not going to watch it. Because, like the puppy beating in your backyard, like, I'm just, like, this idea that I could watch something and to understand it, it's just not possible. It's incomprehensible what happened. And to understand it, to try to look at it over and over and over, to come to terms with it, all that's really occurring is that one has to go numb. Because it's incomprehensible. It's just incomprehensible. And once one goes numb, this is the rap, you know. It's when the gums are numb that the dentist really kicks in with the violence. They don't cut you and drill until you're numb. It's when you're numb that they go for it. And the same way, when people are looking at this thing trying to understand it, they go numb. Fear makes us go numb. I'm not interested in being numb. I want to be alive. So I turned off the television. And I went back and I read a book. And people were calling me, what are you going to do? I'm like, I'm going to read a book. I'm going to read a book. And I looked out the window, and I saw these trees right here outside this window. And I thought, and I saw some birds up there. And I thought, these birds and these trees do not give a fuck about what is occurring in New York City or even a mile away from here. This means nothing to them. It means nothing to them. And if I have to align myself with living beings at that moment, if I had to align myself, I'm going to align myself with the birds and the trees. Because not that I don't care for the people involved. I do care. But I cannot get caught up in the cycle of fear. I thought about World War I, a colossal, disastrous mess where hundreds of thousands of people were killed daily. And still we can laugh and smile today. So I knew that we would navigate this horrific incident. But I was not going to navigate it by becoming inured to my own feeling. Then I sat right here and I got all the mail, because people write me and I answer all my mail. So I got out all the mail and I sat and I dated each one of those things September 10th, because I didn't want people to think I was insane. You know, like, what was he doing writing letters on the 11th, you know? So I wrote September 10th, and I answered like 30 letters that day. And every time I wrote it, I thought, this is a vote for the future. Because I'm writing a letter that someone will read on at least the 12th or the 13th or the 14th. I know those days will come, and that's why I'm writing this. It's a vote for the future. That's just the way I live. It's just the way I am. It's just my way of thinking about these things.
Great way.
It's just a different... I just don't buy into the... It's like, it's all... Like, we can either, like, behave like them, like the bad parts of this world, or we can spend all of our time trying to, like, fight against them. But either way, we get caught up in the same dance. Or we just try to think about, like, life straight up and just be like, okay, this is real. We're here. I didn't become real. I am real. I've always been real. Like, as a kid, I was real. This is a big problem in our lives. Like, people think, oh, kids, well, you know, when you get things get real, you have to get real at some point. Fuck that. You are real when you're 5. You're real when you're 7 and 10 and 12. You're real. You might be more real. I mean, there's nothing more real than a 5-month-old kid who's just like, I'm just shitting out my ass right now. Oh, I'm just spit up. Yeah, I'm tired. I'm hungry. Like, I'm happy. That's just real. That's pure realness right there. He's not wearing the cool hoodie, you know. He's just a kid. He's just real. And I think this idea that children are not real is nuts. But it's, again, like another aspect of our society that just keeps us always scrambling, trying to get caught up just to get back to zero.
don't need a reason.
When we left on the trip, I really anticipated us making a damning document of Americans saying, F you, we're never coming back. I've had my fill. And on the trip, we found that people are just really good. You know, there's more good than there is bad, I think.
I think if you went around the world, you would find that echoed everywhere you go. People are good.
In general, they're really...
people are good. They're just good. And there's like there's problems, certainly, with power. But that, the problem, you know, here's the thing. Like, power. It's like the idea of winning. Like, to be a winner requires a loser. So, like, you know, I play a pickup softball game every Monday or every week in the summer. We play softball. It's a pickup game, punk rock kind of pickup game. And street rules, like, you know, no shame, no strikeouts, no set team. We just play. Whoever comes plays. And I'm an advocate for no scorekeeping because I just want to play softball. I don't give a fuck about what the numbers are. I just want to be the person, like when the ball comes, I want to get the ball and throw it to the person, try to get that person out. Not because I want them out, but I just want to be able to like do the mechanics of the game. That's like what I'm there to do. So then there are other people on the team who are like saying like the people who are like, well, we like the idea of the score. It gives us an idea of like, you know, something to really work towards. So then I said, okay, well, we could do that. But then I was an advocate for what I call the unified scoring concept. Like, so the unified score is great because that way, let's say you have two teams, right? And so at the end of the game, one team has scored 5 times. So another team has scored 4 times. Then the score of the game would be 9. Look, together we got 9 runs, see? Because we're doing it together. That's just like, I just like that idea. Like the idea of, like, I just don't really care. That's the thing about, like, winning requires losing. And I just don't think that we really have to have either. Like, people who are successful, there are a lot of people you talk to who are banned who will tell you, like, they see their success as, like, okay, like, we want to sell records. There are only so many people out there that are going to buy records. So if that person is buying somebody else's record, they're not buying mine. So they will go out of their way to suppress other people's bands. Like, by saying, like, well, it's like the old days when bands used to open for other bands, they'd screw their sound. Like, the headlining band would, like, not let the opening band turn up as loud, or they'd actually would, like, screw their, put their sound through, just make them sound a little worse so there wouldn't be any competition. Or it would not, there is competition, but it would be they would kind of cripple them a little bit. And I just think that's just not the way I would want to live. I think that there's plenty for everybody. And why shouldn't everybody, like, let's just spread the wealth. I'm all for spreading the wealth. I love that thing about how upset the Republicans were about that idea, spread the wealth. They've always been on one end of that, haven't they?
Oh, yeah.
Right, that's their deal. Like, why should we share our shit? Fuck you. Like,
I was surprised by that. I saw John McCain speaking at a union rally. Union people are not rich. They're regular people. And when he said, Barack Obama wants to share the wealth, they all booed.
Right.
And I thought, well, wouldn't you benefit from some of the sharing of the wealth?
Right, but this is the thing. He's coming at it from a... That's the point. Like, he's playing on the idea that the meager bit they have, they'd have to give to other people. But actually, I think what Obama was saying is, like, for those people who have a lot, like...
Give a little.
Of course. It seems so obvious, you know.
Yeah, it does. If you deal with people like that, if you're not such... Individually, I think people are... It's easy to be greedy and not do that stuff.
I mean, there's, like, this idea of, like... The three of us sitting at the table, right? And I have an enormous pile of food. And I'm just eating the food, and you have none. And this goes on for days. And at some point, you're starving. I have much more food than I can possibly eat by myself. So how would it benefit for me to have you both die at this table? It would only be unpleasant, really. You know, you would be upset. As you're dying, you might become violent, and eventually it would probably be somewhat grisly. And then it'd stink because you'd be rotting. You know, why is that a good arrangement? But meanwhile, all the food I have, I can't possibly eat it all, so that food just goes to waste. You know, it just rots there as well. I mean, it's not possible that people who have as much money as they have they could never spend it, ever. But they have it. It's just the piles. They just want the piles. And they just keep thinking, like, that pile should be mine. I have this, like, weird concept, this idea that one could be, like, reasonable and good and wealthy. But to be rich, you have to be an asshole. And what that means is that, like, if you live efficiently and you save, you may end up with a little bit of a pile and what you can live off of. That's being wealthy. Fair enough. But to be rich means that if a dollar drops on this table out of nowhere, like suddenly a dollar appears and drops on the table, I'm like, well, that's mine. And you're like, well, why? We're here too. I'm like, yeah, fuck you. It's like, that's my dollar. That should be mine. I'm entitled to that dollar. And that's being rich. And that's why you have people who, for instance, like when you have, like, say, computer technology is coming out and they're like, well, we want to make money. Then they start figuring out, like, well, if we don't figure out how to erect a toll booth here, that will go out for free. And that dollar should be mine. Why? Why should it be theirs? Why should they have the right? Think about this. Like the typewriter, like the keyboard on the typewriter, which is public domain, right? Nobody has a copyright on that design or any kind of, they don't have any. There's no, like, the QWERTY typewriter. But the computer people are certainly happy to have used it. They've employed it on all their goddamn computers they're making so much money from. But their technologies, they're like, no, that's our intellectual property. Nobody can use that. They can use the keyboard, no problem. But that's where it ends. Like, they could, the tools for them, like the public domain tools, they'll use those. But then their stuff can't be used by anybody else because it's all this idea of intellectual property. It's just a...
DJ
hopeful. Oh yeah, I remember the day before the Gulf War, and I had been invited up to speak at this anti-war rally, and I talked to the guy a couple days before it. Actually, I think there was a day before they actually went in. They were going to say they were going to go in or something. And I said, he said, I mean, he was, I guess, you know, they're going to go in. I said, oh, I don't think they're going. He's like, how can you say that? I said, well, if I think I'm going to, if I just think they're going to go in, if I'm sure they're going to go in, then how can I, why would I be fighting to stop the war? If it's inevitable, what's the point of trying to stop it? To me, it has to be possible that it's not inevitable. Like, that's just, so there's moments where I'm thinking, well, like, you know, I'm just hopeful. And that's just the way I've always operated. That, of course, it's possible. Let's work towards that. I will say this about the Obama thing last night, which I thought was really interesting and something that occurred to me. And this is why I am very hopeful about it. Is that one thing I thought about the seeing the two speeches last night, McCain's speech and the Obama speech. The first thing I thought about was McCain's speech, which was, you know, fairly, I thought it was a very, like, pretty good, nice speech. He was very, like, his concession was gracious. I felt like, oh, this guy seems an all right guy, which is funny because I've been thinking, like, this guy is, I mean, I couldn't look at him anymore. I've gotten so sick of the way he was speaking. But once the pressure was out, he just returned to being, he's a person, you know, and he's saying, like, you know, yeah. I realized at that moment that McCain's big problem, the thing he couldn't get over, was the Republican Party.
Yep.
Because the people who were at his rally were despicable.
Yep.
Just despicable. Like, horrible, not just impolite, but disrespectful. Not to Obama, to McCain. He's trying to make a concession speech and they're booing and acting like animals. You know, like, it's really was, I was like, poor guy. Look what he was up against. And I speak from a point of, I think my point of reference on this is that I have played shows in my life where the audience, there's elements of the audience who are like deeply fucked up people. And I'm like playing a guitar to make music, and I have like maybe 40 white power skinheads in the audience who are like my fans. But I have to own that, because somehow I've allowed my music to become a gathering point for them too. And I felt like I realized he was up against that. McCain had his own little skinhead army there. And that's on him. And I took responsibility for my shit. That's, you know, it's like, you know, I worked on it. I worked hard in my work, you know, to deal with it. I didn't, you know, I dealt with those people straight up. I was like, you're human beings and you can't behave like that.
To the point of being called an asshole about it, almost.
Many times. Yeah. Many times. I wish McCain had said, instead of saying, please, 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 I wish he had just said, that is just disrespectful. Just call him out. So that was very interesting to watch. The Obama speech, I mean, for the last 2 years, Obama has been, he's been kind of savaged by an awful lot of people from all corners. Like, he's gotten a lot of grief. In the last few months, last couple months especially, just absurd charges. Really absurd. And he's been belittled. He's been discounted, he's been insulted, scandalized, perjured, you know, he's due a smirk, you know, he could come out pretty easily and be like, you know, yeah, you know, but I thought his speech was really, again, composed, gracious, inclusionary, which was something I had not really thought about. Feeling like it was inclusionary. He was including everybody. He wasn't booing the Republicans. he was being inclusionary. He was saying, we're all together now. Like, this is it. This is what we're doing. And I thought about the tenor that he struck in that speech and the tenor of that event even. And I was thinking about the many, many, many deeply talented, able people who may feel compelled to public service, who, when actually thinking about going to work for the government, have been faced with this deeply unattractive, offensive operation that the Bush administration has propped up. Deeply divisive, ugly, kind of biased and exclusionary. And I know people who are like, you know, I'd like to do something for the government, but work for the, do some, but I don't want to work for that government. Like, I don't want to work for that. That just, it's sort of like if you go to, you know, you're looking for a job, you're like, you're a painter or something, or, you know, and you're a brilliant painter, but, the only job available is painting, you know, missiles for Lockheed Martin Marietta. Like, they'll pay you a fortune, all that, but basically, you're like, that's just not what I want to do with my life. So you just don't paint. You know, you end up not painting. And I think that that's sort of what has happened, that because the government largely has become destructive, and the tenor of government has become so unpleasant, that many people who would be incredible civil servants just walk away from it. And I wonder if maybe the shift in the tenor may actually reawaken within them this sort of desire to do work for the greater good, which would be profound, because that's where like people say, like, yeah, but I mean, the government, yeah, fine, but bring in people who give a fuck, then you got something that could be quite interesting. Who knows?
Do you think that you would ever do any political stuff, or do you ever think there's a day that you would see
while you do? I'm doing some right now.
Absolutely, everything. But I mean, like, actually run for an office, or like there would be a day where you or Jello or Rollins would, you know, those are the people that I would vote for, you know, I would canvass for some. I would believe in that. Well, it's just the way it is. I don't know why, but when I think of voting, I think that's where my politics came from or whatever. Those are people I believe in for some reason. They've all seemed to have, in different ways, some sort of values or something.
Some people have said to me, oh, you should run for mayor of Washington, but, I mean, I would lose.
Did someone, you said people have said that to you?
Oh, yeah, many people. I don't know if I could do it. I don't know if I could do that, because there's a lot of bureaucratic bullshit, and it just seems like, well, it's not my strength.
So many non-voters that we talk to, I bring up, what do you think of this? I wouldn't tell them when we're coming. The plan from the beginning was to come here. And a lot of them would mention your name or Jello Biafra, right, or something like that.
Well, I appreciate that, but I think what they're looking for is actually they're looking for somebody who's dependable. And I think that quite often music, because records are static, they're frozen moments, they're never changing, they're very dependable. And that's why when bands or artists do things that are very deeply, like, they do something that really veers from that, it kind of stains the record or soils it or makes it unlistenable. Because our relationship with records is so profound. They're static relationships. And the people who made those records are static. I mean, in terms of their performance. However, people continue to change. So I think that when people, I appreciate that people think of me as like, he's dependable. And I think I'm pretty dependable for sure. But what they're reacting to really is just wanting to be able to believe in something. And music is something that you can believe in. But in terms of politics, there are some people I know who are brilliant musicians who I think would be horrific politicians. It's just a different art form. I think, you know, I don't know. I can't really imagine that I would want to do that work, because as it is, I don't have enough time to play guitar now. And that's just, you know, my job is already pretty full time. Like, it's constant for me. I mean,
running the label?
Running it all, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have the label, I have the band. You gotta remember, my work is not just in the present, I'm dealing with all the past. Every band I've been in is still alive to some degree. Not active, but alive. I'm still answering questions about Minor Threat to this day.
I bet.
I'm still dealing with issues about licensing or how things are used or not used.
I understand.
You gotta repress things. I mean, I tend to my legacy. It's a lot of work. But I think of it as it's a living thing, and I have to be careful about it. Because if I ignore it, then it dies. And then when it's dead, it becomes something I have to drag around with me. You don't want to drag around something dead. It takes too long.
No.
I think with, you know, I felt like, I mean, really, honestly, if someone said to me, like, you know, we really need you to do this, I would consider something, but I don't think that that day will never come.